This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 9th of July 2012. Midori House, in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London. I'm Robert Bound. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's been called the accidental coup. How did a below-average military student turned army captain reverse two decades of democratic governance in Mali? We'll find out. We'll do global affairs with our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. Stay tuned to see what elections and scandals and wars have caught Steve's eye this week. And the running of the bulls has descended upon the quiet town of Pamplona once again this year. Two of Monocle's staff have made the journey before, and they'll pop in to tell us their harrowing experiences of life, testosterone and death. We'll also chat about the business of books, and I'll play you a song or two. That's all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's get the news headlines at the top of the hour with Jonathan Wheatley. Monocle 24 News. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met the European Commission President in Jerusalem today and praised a scientific cooperation agreement between the EU and Israel.
This is a very important milestone. Europe is our main trading partner. Europe is an advanced society. We're an advanced society. We're in a decade and a century of innovations, and the more we cooperate, the more it will benefit.
However, José Manuel Barroso, on a three-day visit to the region, reminded Netanyahu of the EU's commitment to a negotiated solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
We have also discussed important political issues. I took this occasion, of course, to express European Union commitment to Israel living in peace. We are, as you know, in favor of a two-state solution. I really think it's a good moment to restart some hope regarding the so-called Middle East peace process.
The genocide trial for Bosnian Serb Army Commander General Ratko Mladic has resumed today at the United Nations War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, with the first witness for the prosecution, Elvedin Pasic, describing mass killings that claimed the lives of many Muslim men.
That night when the heavy shelling started and the firing started, we were in the shell with our neighbors, probably six families all together. It was horrible. I remember as a little kid hear the firing in the air and all that.
South Sudan's President Salva Kiir vowed today to confront corruption as he addressed an assembly of dignitaries and a cheering crowd to mark the nation's first Independence Day since splitting from Sudan. He portrayed the country's economy as part of the country's broader liberation struggle.
Our liberty today is incomplete. We must be more than the brave. We have to be independent economically.
The European Union Election Assessment Team spokesman Alexander Lambsdorff has said that Libya's National Assembly election, the country's first free national poll after 42 years of Muammar Gaddafi's rule, has gone remarkably well.
At the outset of this process, there were hardly any institutions that Libyan authorities could work with for the organization of a democratic election. There was no election commission, there were no political parties, there were no NGOs active in the field of democracy. And in less than 1 year, the country has gone from the fall of Tripoli and the end of the dictatorship to a democratic election that has all these institutions and has seen all these institutions perform in the way they did, and that has been very positive.
And finally, a smoking orangutan in Indonesia who started her very unhealthy habit 9 years ago after visitors threw cigarette butts into her enclosure is moving on to healthier pastures. The 15-year-old female orangutan called Tori is currently at a zoo in the Java town of Soyo, 360 miles east of the capital Jakarta. She's being moved away from visitors to protect herself and four other endangered orangutans. She has been a cause for concern with her nicotine addiction, which she mimicked from humans who were smoking near her enclosure. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24. All right, thank you very much, Jonathan. It's 4 minutes past six here in the UK. And you're listening to the Midori House here on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London ist New York ist Hong Kong ist Tokyo.
Aktien und Monocle 24. Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Λόντωστε καζίν, τέμα ον Monocle 24.
Λόντωμπο, as a Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδά, μπορείς Monocle 24.
Λόντενιστ, σύνο Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que que nina teiro no a Monocle 24?
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 hagatja.
Indeed. Monocle 24. Now, first we're going to Mali's accidental coup. How does a country twice the size of France with two decades of democracy behind it lose its president and government overnight? And, sort of, by accident. We're joined now by a journalist who's well acquainted with this story and who wrote a report over the weekend on it, Rukmini Kalimachi, the West Africa Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. And Rukmini joins us now on the line from Niger. Welcome to Midori House.
Good to be with you.
Now, this sort of sounds funny. We'll come to the less humorous bits of it after we've got the lowdown on exactly what this accidental coup consisted of, Rukmini. Can you fill us in?
Well, it was basically a mutiny that went too far. It started in the main military camp in the capital, which is not very far from the presidential palace. The defense minister had come to address the soldiers there because they were planning to do a march to protest various things they were not happy about. And in the course of that speech, the defense minister talked in a way that really annoyed them. The group of soldiers started to get rowdy, and at a certain point, they got so rowdy that the defense minister's bodyguards started shooting in the air. And at that point, all hell broke loose. The soldiers ran to the armory, they broke in, they got the guns, and they started marching towards the palace. And according to the interviews that I did, initially what they were going to do is just dress down the president. They were very upset about how the president had handled a rebellion in the country's north. A lot of soldiers were dying. But when they got to the palace, they found that the president had fled. So the seat of power essentially fell into their laps, and it went from there.
And the piece that you wrote for the AP is quite a piece full of colour. One of the best things is the protagonist of this accidental coup, who's a sort of accidental protagonist. This is Captain Amadou Sanogo, who's sort of caught up in it. And he was the person that, because of his good English and he'd been schooled or militarily schooled abroad in the US, etc., he sort of was almost snatched as a figurehead for this coup. What's the fallout of it for him? I mean, is he taking to the task with aplomb, or is he still looking around kind of wild-eyed?
Well, he seems to have settled in quite well. He immediately after the coup, he took over the office of the zone commander that was the commander of that particular barracks. The reporters that came there to interview him saw that, you know, week after passing week, his guys just kept on bringing more and more things, you know, to outfit the office. They were pouring cement, laying down new electrical lines. One day I saw a truck full of brand new fake leather chairs that were being brought in. So really, you know, he came off as a guy that was making himself right at home. There's been multiple, you know, negotiations with him, agreements, at least two agreements that were signed calling for him to step down. But what we're hearing on the ground is that he's sort of out of the picture now, but there's still a lot of, you know, really confusing stuff going on. For instance, businessmen are still showing up with money to give to him. Why do you give him money if he's still not in control?
And maybe you could fill us in on the sort of political complexion of Mali. As we said in the introduction, it's a huge country, and it's sort of been regarded in recent times as a bit of a fostering ground for Al-Qaeda. Is this the sort of, I mean, as silly as an accidental coup sounds, there's obviously some serious repercussions of this. What is the Al-Qaeda link and the sort of, how do you see the political future of Mali playing out after this?
Right, absolutely. Well, it's actually a really sad story because for years and years, those of us who cover West Africa, we used to always, we talk about this part of the world that is very troubled and that has a lot of coups, but the exceptions were really Senegal, Mali, and Ghana, if you consider just West Africa. So now one of those examples of what we thought was a stable democracy has essentially just been washed away. Of course, things were much more complex under the face of it. People that lived in Mali said that this image of democracy was overwrought, that it was really a facade, that there was a lot of corruption. And part of that is what's happened with the North. This is a country that is immense, twice the size of France. And the North is this area that is, it's basically a desert. It's the south, it's the southern edge of the Sahara Desert. And that land, because it's ungoverned, because the government of Mali has not been able to assert its control there, became, starting in 2003, a base for something called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AKIM, as we call it. And it's that group is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. They merged with Al-Qaeda, I believe, a couple of years ago. And they're responsible for suicide bombings, for kidnapping foreigners, at least 50 foreigners since 2003. And this group, in the wake of this coup, this group allied with some other rebel groups, has now succeeded essentially in becoming the de facto rulers of the north of Mali.
And Rukmini, just to go back to this coup, it was obviously TV was the way that the populace understood that this thing was happening. And I think Captain Sonogo's mother first saw her son on the TV as the sort of leader of this coup. It's obviously always the classic way that coups are sort of announced. What's the sort of TV culture like? I mean, are there lots? Is there one state-run broadcaster that is the sort of prime target for anyone partaking in a coup?
Exactly. It's the first thing that I learned when I came to West Africa in late 2006. When a coup goes down, it always goes down on TV. That's sort of after the presidential palace. That's the first thing that the coup plotters take over, and it's as simple usually as announcing that they're in control. Because oftentimes, the other side is too weak or unable to fight back. The reaction of his family was quite funny. I had to go through his hometown, Ségou, when I was on my way to cover the coup, because right after the coup, Mali closed its borders and closed the airport. So I was not able to fly in. I had to go in by land. And so I ended up on my travels there, going through Ségou, which is where he grew up. And it was there that I was able to interview his cousin, and other family friends, who said that on the morning of the coup, nobody was more surprised than his parents, because they had just seen him a couple of weeks ago. He had come to say goodbye. He had been accepted into another foreign training program, and he was planning to go abroad. So on the morning of the coup, suddenly they wake up, and instead of seeing, the normal newscast or what one would see on the TV channel, they see their son, who's announcing that he's, that he's overthrown the government. Apparently, his father said, woke the mother and said, "Come see what your imbecile son is doing."
Well, it sounds as incredulous as it sounds. It's obviously a serious situation at the same time. Rukmini Kalamachi on the line from Niger. Thank you very much for joining us. And remember to check out tonight's Monocle Daily for an equally intriguing story coming out of Mali. That's 2200 hours London time. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, we'll be heading to Syria. Stay with us.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
All this week on Monocle 24, we're looking into the fast-developing, futuristic and highly controversial world of unmanned aerial technology, or drones to you and me. Whether it's the lives of those who pilot them remotely, the latest technology on the market, or how the theatre of war may never be the same again, drones are changing the face of defence for good. We speak to the journalists, commentators and advocates at the front line each day this week on The Globalist and The Daily here on Monocle 24.
You are tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. A civil war in Syria rages and the death toll reportedly reaches more than 15,000. The country's president, Bashar al-Assad, has given a television interview to German channel Das Erste. In it, he defends his government's actions and insists he still has popular support. Here's a clip.
You say the United States is politically supporting the rebels. Yeah. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And you say these rebels, whom you call terrorists, kill civilians. This means you are accusing the American government of being at least partly responsible for the killing of innocent Syrian civilians. Is that correct?
Of course, exactly. As long as you offer any kind of support to terrorists, you are a partner. Whether you send them armament or money or public support, political support in the United Nations, anywhere, any kind of support, this is implication.
You know that Western politicians see the situation differently.
Yeah.
And they are discussing a military intervention in Syria. How would you react? Would you retaliate against Western countries?
No, it's not about the retaliation. It's about defending our country. Our priority is to defend our country, not to retaliate to anyone. This is our duty, and this is our aim.
And you're prepared for such an attack?
Whether you're prepared or not, you're going to defend your country. But you have to be prepared.
All right, that was Bashar al-Assad speaking to Das Erste, the German TV channel. And earlier today, Scott Lucas, professor at the University of Birmingham and the editor of the popular foreign affairs blog EA Worldview, joined us to discuss what impact the interview might have.
I find this interesting that this is President Assad's second major interview of the week. He also gave a lengthy interview to a Turkish newspaper. And in both cases, he's reaching out to foreign media, to media of countries who, in fact, are lined up against him in this international coalition. And he's trying to say, one, look, I have legitimacy. I have authority, whatever you've heard about this conflict. Two, those who are challenging me don't have that legitimacy, and it's wrong if you support them. And three, if you continue to support them, make no mistake, I will continue to stand my ground. In other words, I'm not going to accept any political deal to step down from power.
But are those claims of legitimacy and authority going to convince anyone, given the massive weight of evidence to the contrary?
I don't think it's going to convince many people outside Syria who already believe that Assad has lost authority. So I don't think you can see a U.S. Secretary of State like Hillary Clinton converting, or, say, a British Foreign Secretary like William Hague switching sides. It may, however, and this is the other key element in the puzzle, it may give Assad some room with the United Nations envoy Kofi Annan, who is in Damascus today, rather unexpectedly, for a series of talks with Assad. Because what Assad is also pressing alongside these interviews is the idea that there is some type of political deal that is possible as long as he remains in power. He does have some support for that point of view from Russia, and he has support for that point of view from Iran. And what he's trying to do is to build up a coalition, basically, that is on his side, as opposed to the one that you've referred to, which is generally most of the European powers, the United States, and many Arab states.
He is certainly trying to position himself as the only individual capable of holding Syria together, isn't he?
I think he is, and I think that the real danger to that is not actually someone who can challenge him directly, because we don't really see an opposition that can step in and take control. It's almost a disconnect, in Assad's own words, from the political situation. So what I found most striking about the interview, beyond the politics that we're discussing, is either he has no idea of what is going on the ground with the mass killings, or he is just completely deluded himself into an explanation that it's all the fault of armed gunmen and not of his own military and his own pro-regime militia. And I'm almost at a loss at this point. I wish I could analyze what's happening, but it appears to be like a disconnect, that he simply no longer has a grasp on what's happening, not in Damascus, but, say, in Ahula, where more than 100 people died last month, or in homes where thousands of people have died in the last few months.
Mm. It certainly does prompt a question which isn't often asked, probably because the answer is quite elusive. But does anyone actually know what's really going on at the top of Syrian government? Is Assad in control or is he a puppet to others?
I think rather than taking the control and puppet notion, I would go a step further, and that is that what has increasingly happened is sort of a decentralization of violence. And by that I mean the Syrian military is stretched because the nature of this insurgency, almost from when it started in March 2011, is that it's all across the country in different areas. And so to try to put it down in the northwest or in the northeast or in the southwest is like trying to nail jelly to a wall. So what has happened is that rather than the Syrian military carrying out these killings and attacks, increasingly you have these pro-regime militia known as Shabia who have gone in and basically in some cases wiped out entire villages. And so with that decentralization of violence, that's the situation spins out of control. Because there is an argument here that President Assad is not in control of these people, and indeed his own established military is not necessarily in control of those who think they're defending the regime by carrying out these killings.
And that was EA Worldview editor Scott Lucas talking to Monocle's Chloe Potter. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. That was a very short sting. Coming up next, we'll be speaking to Steve Bloomfield, Global Affairs Editor at Monocle. But first, what better way to cue him up than with some Stones? And that was Beast of Burden by the Rolling Stones, which in no way sets up my next guest, Foreign Editor Steve Bloomfield. You're going to give us your Global Affairs Roundup. I billed you as the Global Affairs Editor because I sort of looked at the script and I sort of looked at the people.
It works.
Yeah, and it all went all over the place there for a second.
Well, Global Affairs is like Foreign.
Exactly. I don't think there's much difference to it, is there? As to expect, it sounds grander though, doesn't it?
It does. Well, what Global Affairs Editor?
Global Affairs Editor.
Well, the advantage of Foreign Editor is it can't be in any way misconstrued when you say, "What do you do?" I do Global Affairs.
Yeah, exactly.
That can be and has been misconstrued.
It can be. It could be a little bit girl in every port.
Yes.
Anyway, let's segue neatly to South Sudan.
Yes, indeed. So, for my global affairs this week, we're going to... Yes, so two African countries, African stories I wanted to talk about today. One is South Sudan. If you've been listening to other shows on Monocle 24 today, you'll be well aware that today is the first anniversary of South Sudan's independence. Mm-hmm. They became independent on the 9th of July last year. It's been a slightly rocky first year for them. I was fairly critical of the government today in my monologue and also of the West, who we've been very, the West generally has been very, very supportive of South Sudan because during the civil wars, the 20-year civil war, which they had with the North, with Khartoum, the South were seen as the good guys because they weren't Omar al-Bashir, they weren't committing genocide or human rights abuses in Darfur. These were seen as the guys to back.
And when after a year of government,
yes,
the worms start coming to the surface.
Well, it's more that now it's. I struggle to think of any liberation movement anywhere in the world that has made the transition from successful liberation movement to truly democratic political party. In every country, it's been problems. The best example is probably in South Africa, where the ANC is still democratic, but there are certain issues there as well.
And do you say there's being a will to get things right, or do you think the government are enjoying their sort of moment in the sun, their little bit of corruption and their gold taps? I mean, is there the will to make it work?
The president even admits that $4 billion has gone missing. And that's a lot of money to go missing. 75 yeah. different officials have been named as being on the receiving end of this largesse. And there's been a rather plaintive plea for them to please give it back, which has so far fallen on deaf ears. There's enormous problems in South Sudan. I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next year as to whether the West, that's been such a staunch ally of the South during the Civil War, whether it's going to take a different tack and say, no, actually, we're going to start demanding some things of you, like freedom of the press, which isn't too bad there, but still, like proper anti-corruption laws, and trying to sort out jobs and education and healthcare.
And do you think is it in the West's interest generally to be friends with South Sudan as opposed to the North, having supported it for 20 years during that civil war? Do they feel that they not necessarily need to get something out of it, but can use it as a bit of leverage in that part of the world?
Possibly. I think it's more they just... It's quite tricky to switch from being completely on someone's side and in someone's corner to then saying, well, actually, we do have some concerns. And I think that they found it slightly difficult, partly because they have such bad relationships with the North, and partly also because China has been very keen to become South Sudan's new best friend. And so the US, the EU, Britain, France individually are also quite keen to not let the Chinese do that. So I think that's going to be intriguing to see what happens on that. There's another African story I want to mention.
Where are we going next?
Let's go to Congo.
Okay.
There's a rebel group in Congo called M23.
Oh, man.
Not M24.
Imagine if we had to do an hour less of work a day. We'd be potentially a rebel group.
Or imagine if this rebel group...
I think that's what you call a trade union.
If this rebel group had just decided to call themselves M24, it would have made a Google alert searches a little bit odd for a
Very
while.
Very interesting.
Yes. So there's a rebel group in the east of Congo called M23, which is a mix of some old rebel groups. They've slightly renamed, reformed. And they're playing some of their old hits.
Okay, what's their hits? What do they do? What do they trot out to the fans?
Their main hit is, and the last time this was in 2008, and I was there at the time, they took the town of Rutshuru in North Kivu and then threatened to take Goma, which is the capital of Eastern Congo, the biggest city there. And this time, almost to the day, 4 years ago, they took Rutshuru and then amassed just outside Goma, a city about a quarter of a million people, and threatened to take Goma. They are probably not going to do the same this time. They've pulled out of Rutshuru now, despite having shown they've taken it. But what this does is it just brings Congo back into the media spotlight, shows that what's going on there still hasn't been sorted.
It sounds like their greatest hits need a bit of polishing up, Steve.
They do a little bit, yeah.
Thank you for joining us. We're going to let you get off to the theatre now.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Steve, for dropping in. Coming up in the next hour of the programme, we'll run with the Bulls, learn the business of books and play a few tunes. But first, it's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Londonból ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から, Monocle 24 です.
De Londres, este é a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Londos, tema on Monocle 24.
Londra'dan, burası Monocle 24.
London から, Monocle 24.
My mistake, my apologies. Now, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Rob. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met the European Commission President in Jerusalem today. José Manuel Barroso, on a three-day visit to the region, reminded Netanyahu of the EU's commitment to a negotiated solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The genocide trial for Bosnian Serb Army Commander General Ratko Mladic has resumed today at the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, with witnesses for the prosecution describing mass killings that claimed the lives of many Muslim men. South Sudan's President Salva Kiir vowed today to confront corruption as he addressed an assembly of dignitaries and a cheering crowd to mark the nation's first Independence Day since splitting from Sudan. And a European Union election assessment team spokesman has said that Libya's recent National Assembly election, the country's first free national poll after 42 years of Muammar Gaddafi's rule, has gone remarkably well. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Robert Bound. It's that time of the year again when intrepid and foolish young souls from Bogota to Perth venture to the cobblestone streets of Pamplona to sprint like maniacs away from charging 900-kilo beasts with sharpened horns. And I'm joined in the studio now by two of those maniacs. Can I call you maniacs? We've got Santiago Tarditi, our edits editor and Adrian Craddock, researcher on Monocle 24. Chaps, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thanks, Rob.
I want to know, I'm going to have to kind of, we'll put it into a little bit of context first, but I'm sure people have heard these are the sort of pictures that ping around the news wires. Everyone's seen the pictures on their news websites and their newspapers. This looks like a dangerous but romantic business. Do you both feel like Ernest Hemingway when you're there? Adrian, paint us a picture.
I don't know if it's that glamorous, actually. I mean, I was there last year, and it seems like the whole event is kind of designed to kind of bring as much chaos and carnage to the people who are participating. Because, I mean, the first run starts at 8 a.m., and anyone who's been to Pamplona knows that the opening night before the first run is probably the biggest party you'll ever go to in your life.
So most people have got an hour's sleep maximum before they
there's a lot
jump
of bleary-eyed
in the way of the beast. You can't sleep because whoever snoozes loses. And the whole idea is that you have to get the best seat, which is usually on a fence that guards the route where the bulls are running. So I remember when I went, it was probably like 5 years ago, and we arrived to the place, we elbowed our way to the fence, and we took turns sleeping, short naps. Otherwise,
so you've gone on guard duty for your spot. And is it?
I was the same, actually. I slept in a churchyard the day I got there because the whole town is completely booked out. I slept in a hedge.
And how's it working? Tell me about that. The phrase booked out, kind of, I think I've done some what can only be described as rudimentary research before you guys came into the studio. Is it a ticketed event? I mean, do you actually, or is it just first come, first serve? People are parking their asses out in churchyards and on the streets.
It's very just crazy. It's maniac. People are take over the streets. Thousands of people. I remember when I was there, a van full of beers was trying to drive by, trying to restock one of the bars, and people just climbed onto the truck and started unloading all the beer that never reached its original destination. People are just having loads of fun. Everybody's dressed in white and red. Everybody's drinking a lot of calimocho, which is basically very cheap wine mixed with Coca-Cola.
That's everyone's favorite Spanish drink, but they just won't admit it, right? And what's the thing like? I mean, it's obviously a thing that seems to be a sort of pagan ritual, a test of machismo, etc. But is it as sort of classic as it used to be, or have brands and things become involved in it? Do you get the feeling that it hasn't changed in sort of 400 years?
Mm. Well, there's the traditional runners who take that very, very seriously, and they pay their respects to the local saint whenever they run. And of course, then there's the odd drunk tourist, especially from
why are you looking at me?
Adrian's side of the world.
Are you suggesting his accent isn't quite as good as yours?
Well, you know, it's the typical gringos. The gringos are the people that actually interrupt and can be dangerous for the race because the locals train. They know how to run the corners. They know where they have to slow down. They know what terraces they can climb in mm-hmm. case the bull gets too close.
This is the thing. There was a story in the paper today. I think an American and two Brits have been gorged or gored. Mm. They certainly had a horn up their posterior in more ways than one, and they're sort of in A&E in Ouch. Pamplona at the moment.
Well, it's very true what you were saying. There are these kind of old guys who take it very seriously. I remember when I was there last year, I think it was an Australian actually, in the final part where there's just a bull in a bull ring and about 100 people who this bull's just kind of terrorising. There was one kind of Aussie guy who went up and was very disrespectful to the bull and kind of tugged its tail. And this guy, this old guy from the back of the stadium, walked all the way down. He must have been about, you know, 70 years old, waited for his moment until this Australian guy came to the edge and just punched him square in the face for just showing such disrespect for the bull. Because there's this real kind of tradition where, you know, obviously the bull's going to get done away with by the end of the day. But there's still this real.
But there
respect.
Is an art to it. There's a subtlety to it. You're like a toreador. You're not just a kind
exactly.
of boozy tourist. You're not. It's not. It's not an MTV format.
That's
you're
definitely
not,
how I see myself.
You're not Johnny Knoxville. you're kind of. You're in a rich tradition of sort of male entertainers and traditionalists, I suppose.
Definitely, yeah.
And is there sort of a professional approach to it? I mean, is there a best place to sit? Like when you're watching race cars, you have to sit in the slowest bit of the track so you see the most action. Well, is it like that? I mean, what are the subtleties to performing in it and to watching it?
I mean, it might sound really basic, but good shoes are extremely important. And I'll tell you why, because as I say, the night before is this massive...
What about those?
I don't think they'd cut it. I think okay. too much slip, not enough kind of what traction
pink,
on those.
Pink laces. You've got to be kidding.
That's yeah. red. It's the studio lights.
Bulls will go straight for that. But seriously, because the night before, there is this massive party and the streets are just completely trashed. And then at 8 a.m. when the Bulls are ready to run, this kind of street sweeper goes all through the track and leaves it completely wet and completely slippery, which makes it even more dangerous.
For so both the runners and the Bulls.
Yeah. So
and
really
you see
good.
The Bulls crashing against the fences all the time. I think the best where I sat was close to the entrance of the Bull ring, the Bull arena, because it's where the good runners arrive to. The other runners just stay behind or stagger or fall or whatever. So the best runners make it to the end and to the start, to the entrance of the plaza.
And just before tell us just before we go, because we're going to have to wrap it up soon. I felt like we've been sort of running towards your questions ever quick. Yeah. How do you win this? Is there a winner? I mean, we know what happens to the Bulls. Do you
basically,
eat them afterwards,
die,
or do they? What happens to them?
If you die, you lose. That's basically how it works. The
lessons
way to win
from
is
life
to survive.
There from Adrian Craddock. If you die, you're basically lost. Okay, so there's no dead winners.
I don't think so. I mean, I think the one kind of trophy that you can have to kind of tell your friends is if you touch the Bull. And I want to tell you right now, I touched the Bull.
Where did you touch it?
on its bum. Not in a weird way. Just as it was going past, I touched
That's
it.
That's the easiest. But that, okay. So the best thing is to have a sort of a gash across the palm where you
just
you
slap
you
on the
parried it. You parried its gorging head.
That's, something like that.
I've made that sound weird. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me to tell us about Pamplona Bull Run. I don't know. There's obviously a way of settling who's the more macho of the two of you, and we'll do that in a separate show.
Sure.
For the time being, Santiago Tarditi and Adrian Craddock, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a second.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Olympics are coming to London. And to Monocle 24. From the 27th of July and throughout the Games, we'll be going faster, higher and stronger, bringing some of the icons of the Games into Midori House, as well as taking Midori House out on the road with a series of special shows from across the city. Monocle 24, keeping a sporting eye and an ear on the Olympics.
And you're tuned into Midori House. It's 1840 here in London. We're talking about books in a minute, so what better way to set that up? This is All Good Books by Paul Weller.
Jesus could hear us now. Bending all his words of which his proud.
And that was Paul Weller singing All Good Books, and you're tuned into Midori House. It's 1844 here in London. We're playing that song because we've got Tom Tivenin in to do our Business of Books section. And he's the features editor of The Bookseller, the journal of record for the bookselling industry.
The organ of the book trade.
The organ of the book trade, no less. And it also says here the go-to spot on the web for daily news and comment about the book business. I imagine that the website is kind of less important to you than the rag, is it?
No, both are quite important now. In fact, more people are coming on and commenting every day on the website.
Are they kind of
venting their spleen on the website.
Are they?
Yeah.
They're wondering whether you'd rather be an organ or a journal.
Yeah, exactly.
and some of the trends that you've flagged up for us are sort of about devices rather than books themselves. Japanese e-books. This is something that didn't take off, but now they're kind of trying to change that all around.
Yeah, strangely, you kind of think of Japan and it's this sort of high-tech sort of world, but it's not really. Well, it's not in terms of e-books. Sony launched their e-reader about 6 years ago, didn't sell any, about 500,000 units, which is terrible, but Kindle will probably sell that many in the UK this year, this month, I mean. And there's a number of reasons why it hasn't taken off, partly because the Sony reader didn't support manga, which is about 25% of the...
Seems like a big, strange problem.
Japanese publishers are quite conservative and didn't want to cannibalize their sales. But this couple of weeks, we're going to see about 3 or 4 big devices being launched. It's kind of been called the black ships moment in Japan, which refers to the 2 black-hulled ships from America that came over in the 1800s that kind of opened up Japan to trade in the West. Uh-huh. So they're all... Japanese publishers are gearing up and ready to...
So this is a proper this is something that everyone's sort of bating their breath for.
Yes.
And are Japanese bookshops scared? I mean, is this something that... I mean, obviously, it's making more and more of an imprint in Western publishing. Japanese are, as you say, surprisingly traditional when it comes to how they read newspapers and books.
I don't think the Japanese bookshops are too worried about it right now. And in fact, a couple of the big Japanese shops are kind of getting into the ebook game, and they're really... they're going to be selling the devices and selling online. Amazon doesn't have a real presence in Japan yet, which is probably good for the Japanese economy, the book business in Japan, because more competitors is better for the ebook business.
And who's making these devices?
Well, Rakuten, who own the Kobo. Kobo sold in the UK and the US. Sony is coming out with finally a device that kind of is cutting edge. It's a sort of almost tablet-like
eating device.
Not
a Walkman.
No. Although I love the Walkman.
Everyone loves the Walkman. It's just like a talking book. Right?
And another company called Toppin, which is bringing out a nice device. And the Kindle will finally be launching in probably in the autumn. So,
and from having looked at these devices, or at least looked, sort of had a browse on the web about what they're about, do you think, I mean, are they very simple, like something like the Kindle? They do one job pretty well, or are they, do they kind of want to be all things to all people? Do they want to be playing music at you and doing all sorts of other devices?
Not necessarily music, but more all things to all people in terms of their full color, mm-hmm. and they support manga and Japanese characters as well, which was a problem. One of the reasons why Kindle hasn't been in yet is because there's some conversion problems with Japanese characters.
So we need to sort of watch that space. You'll be monitoring that, I suppose. Yes. I mean, it's a sort of interesting thing if the e-books can sort of hammer away at that surprisingly traditional edifice of sort of Japanese publishing. Yeah. All right, next we're going to Europe, and this sounds like an inside story, but it sounds like an interesting one, an important one. France and Luxembourg sort of not being paying their ebook VAT.
Well, they lowered their VAT, which is against EC rules. Just a little background: ebooks, ridiculously, are kind of classed as software or service, electronic services by the EC. So, if you like, for example, in the UK, where we don't pay any VAT on print books, mm-hmm. we have to pay 20% VAT on an ebook, even if it's the same product, essentially. So what France and Luxembourg have done is said, well, we're not going with that. We're going to lower our ebook rate, our VAT rates, to 3% and 7% respectively.
So this sounds like a sensible idea, but presumably, it being Europe and everyone having to agree on everything, there'll be some fallout. Tom.
Yes. Well. They've been slapped, France and Luxembourg, with a
wrapped over the knuckles. Yeah,
an infringement order, and they have to go back to the EC and tell them why they're doing this, and they'll probably be fined. The irony is that in 2013, the EC is going to change their rules so that they'll bring that down to the level of regular books.
But they have to. But France and Luxembourg, in the interim, have to sort of be investigated
for the 9 months. Yeah.
And who does it? Well, who does this involve? Is this make a sort of, you know, remarkable difference to the way that people will shop? Do you think, you know, have people started rushing to? I know Luxembourg is obviously a backwater by which people sort of don't pay tax for all sorts of things. I know buying records and DVDs and books online, a lot of them come via Luxembourg in order to avoid things like that.
Well, Amazon has its Europe base there.
Yeah.
So any ebook you have bought from Amazon in the UK, Germany, Spain, it has come from Luxembourg, and they've only paid 3% VAT on that to Luxembourg and not the 20% VAT to the UK government. So Amazon is this is perfectly legal. We should say that before Amazon's lawyers. Yes, Amazon's been avoiding quite a bit of VAT.
Spain, we're going to move south. Yes. It's getting a bit chilly up in Luxembourg, yeah. there, wasn't it? All yes. that tax talk, Tom. What's happening in Spain? Is the publishing industry sort of following the general sort of demise, Spanish demise or economic demise?
Absolutely. It's in free fall. The Spanish Publishing Association last week released a report about the 2011 results. Normally, they release this in February, March, but they've waited to July to do it, probably because it's such bad news. Basically, the Spanish publishing revenue has declined for about 20% in the last 4 years since the recession. Compare that with the UK or other markets in Europe, it's about 9%. You know, so we're seeing a massive freefall in the revenue from Spanish publishers.
But what about that for Latin America? Latin America, I mean, the last five great books I've read seem to have been translations from Spanish or from Latin American Spanish. This is a serious thing for all of us that love books, presumably.
Well, the interesting thing is that Latin America is buoyant and Spanish publishers are doing very well in Latin America. And, you know, their profits have risen by 5% in this year. So all this decline has come from Spain itself with its terrible economy. You know, there's a bunch of trade wars going on in between Spain and Latin America. Argentina last year banned the sale of imported books on health and safety grounds, saying the ink was poisonous, basically.
Saber rattling if ever there was one. Just before we go, Tom, does this mean that there's more sort of conservative commissioning in Spanish publishing? They need to sell a certain amount so they can't take any risks?
Yeah, I think you will see more and more of the big books. Spain's a real high for historical fiction, so there will be more of the Carlos Ruiz Zafón and that sort of thing, and going for the sure hits rather than the kind of literary gunslingers.
All right, Tom Tivenin, features editor of The Bookseller. Thank you very much for filling
Thank
us
you.
In. It's 1852 here in London, and you're tuned in to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Esse är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 dagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 är jag också.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The
Proper
Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You are indeed tuned in to Monocle 24. This is Midori House. Now, a project that started in Barcelona in 2010, named Walking Gallery, where artists march around a city with their own creations strapped to their bodies, has now arrived in East London. José Putz, a Spanish painter and graphic artist, has come up with a concept for a walking gallery, and the idea is to confront people going about their daily business with art. Monocle's Anna França spoke to José to find out more.
Zigzagging between the crowds of London's Brick Lane and Red Shirt Street, a group of artists has decided to take the canvases beyond the gallery walls and into the public eye. After success in Barcelona, Madrid, São Paulo and Buenos Aires, the Walking Gallery founder and director, José Puig, has brought the exhibition to London.
I started because something inside me woke up all of a sudden. I needed to showcase my work somehow and feel the real drive of being an artist. In a city like Barcelona, where competition is ruthless, I felt I had to bring my work to the street to be in the public eye immediately. I noticed that people were saying things about my work, how good it was, that they wouldn't mind having it at home. People stopped me, asked me about my work, told me I was crazy, and I had a chance to explain my concept. We leave our house every day with drawings on our t-shirts, on our bags, brands scattered all over.
As the instruments to produce and display one's artwork expand alongside technology, artists are increasingly enjoying a wealth of media outlets that their 20th century counterparts could only have dreamt of. So can this democratic way of liaising with your potential market be the way forward for young artists eager to ditch the middleman? Susanna Negre is the director of Wen Gallery in Aldgate East and responsible for the London version of the Walking Gallery.
I believe there is a new trend for the new generations of artists. I think the project is really based on emerging artists, established artists, and it's a project which is developed and gives the opportunity. So it's really interesting to see how the project, which started in 2010, has been growing for 2 years. It's been established now in Spain, in 10 cities. And we're promoting and we're bringing the project into the international market. So the reactions, they have been so far so good. In Sao Paulo, for instance, we already have done two editions. In Buenos Aires, it's been three of them as well. The reactions in Latin America, they are excellent. And then, yeah, and it's really interesting feedbacks because some of the artists, they have sold their works. Some of the artists, they have reviews on the art press, which is thus an excellent outcome. The plan from Walking Galleries to create is a platform. So we are working into for the next few months to prepare, organize a series of workshops. So we want to mentor the artists. We want to help them to be able to exhibit. So in order to get, sell their work and get, make some profit.
The wait is over. A dozen young artists gather outside the tube station, waiting for José to lead the way. The group forms an orderly line, their meter-high paintings eclipsing half their smiles. Residents and commuters take their compact cameras and mobile phones out of their pockets and start capturing the moment all the way down Wretched Street. Sally Jean is from Brooklyn, New York, and her painting has the thick, slightly elongated strokes of a Monet. She captured a woman and her dog, but through fake, oversized smiles over both their mouths. Sally is with Luca, an Italian student, and they are both enrolled in the London School of Representational Art. Both believe an artist should be proactive when it comes to building a market.
I think it's very important to get people just exposed to the art that we do. And it's very hard to get a chance if you don't kind of pick up and try and do it yourself, so to speak. A lot of artists, I feel, have the attitude of, you know, producing the artwork and then hoping that something will happen.
So could this be the future of selling art?
You never know when you're walking down the street who you're going past and who might be interested in art or looking to buy something or just what you've done speaks to them. So I think it's always an option.
The Walking Gallery will be showing the streets of Santiago and City of Mexico to their own artists next. In London, through the flamboyant early evening streets of the artsy district, they have turned a lot of heads. When aesthetic art galleries and faceless business deals are the industry standard, it is refreshing to see a handful of professionals still enthused by personal interaction. For Monocle in London, I am Anna France.
Nice, and that was The Walking Gallery by Anna Franca with the Spanish painter and graphic artist José Puig. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Jakes. Up after the news is this week's brilliant culture show. Today we hear about the new project from the creators of In the Dark Radio.
We made a very impassioned plea and our wishes were granted and it's turned into our very own radio record store.
And in 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, Ted Kravitz and Don Reynolds will be back for the Monocle Daily and Andrew Miller will be back from Dory House at the same time for tomorrow. But for now, thanks for tuning in.